Listener discretion is advised. You've dropped into Juice Box Radio, where sexuality educators quench your search for responsible, progressive sexuality over your lifespan. Don't touch that dial. You are exactly where you want to be. You've landed in Juice Box Radio on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Maybe you're one of our online listeners at CITR.ca. If you ever miss a show, you can always download a podcast at juiceboxradio.com. Any way that you've come to spend this hour with us, we're glad to have you. So tonight's show is speaking to the history of BDSM. And for those of you who don't know what BDSM stands for, that's bondage, discipline, sadism, and masochism. That is a technical word for BDSM, but it kind of reaches a lot more than that, and we're going to be finding out all about that and more with special guest Peter Tupper. Welcome, Peter.
Glad to have you. Glad to be here.
Great. Awesome. And we're going to be taking calls, so feel free to call in and contribute to the conversation that we're going to be having tonight. Do call at 604-822-2487, and that's if you have any kind of crazy BDSM stories or you heard something that we're talking about tonight with our guest, that you know you maybe have something to contribute to that, or you've had an experience with it, or what have you. Please do feel free to call in at 604-822-2487.
We definitely want the Penthouse Letters version of that. You guys all know how I feel about that. So, Peter.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much for coming out to see us tonight.
No problem at all.
And I wanted to say and ask you really quickly, I know I asked the other day, but if you could tell our listeners, why do you call your company Mighty Fast Pig?
Okay, that's the company I do for my freelance writing gig. Mm-hmm. It's based on a story by Chuck Jones, who is a guy who made a bunch of the old Warner Brothers cartoons, and he's one of the big famous animators in American animation.
Mm-hmm.
He had this anecdote that he liked to tell that he was trying to learn to be a classical artist when he was a very young man. This was in the 1920s. And he went off to art school, and he thought he was a failure at it. And he went back home, and he found his favorite eccentric uncle, who said, and he asked him, "What's wrong?" And Chuck Jones said, "I can't do this. I mean, I just don't have the talent for this. You can't make a pig into a racehorse." And his uncle looked at him and said, "Well, yes, that's true, but you can make a mighty fast pig."
Aha.
And so I've always taken that as that's my personal motto.
Aha. I like that. You've done a lot of different things. You were at Langara, you're mentioning. You did the journalism program there.
Yep. And I'm also a UBC grad, class of 94, with a BA in history.
Very, very cool. So what made you interested? You've been involved with the kink scene in Vancouver for over 10 years?
I'd say about 12, yeah.
About 12 years. What... How have you found that the scene's changed in the last 10 years, 12 years?
It's changed a lot. I mean, I've been around through several generations of the people in the Vancouver kink scene, and there's been, I could tell you tales about
politics. I do want to hear all the tales.
Well, yeah, except I'd wake up with like a horse's head in my bed the next day. It's changed a lot. I think that we're actually living in a golden age of the Vancouver's kink scene right now.
In what way?
Like, when I got started out, the first thing I ever went to was, like, a bar night that was about the only thing for heterosexual people, at least, to go to.
Okay, would that be more like a Sin City kind of deal?
No, it wasn't even a Sin City thing. Okay. It was just, you went to a bar, you talked, you chatted, you met people, and maybe there was, like, some woman had a birthday spanking, and that was it. And the only play party, at least for straight people, again, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what was going on with the gays and lesbians at that point, but... the only thing for straight people, play party, was at, I believe it was called the Red Dot, or the Red Spot.
Okay.
Yeah, this was in this grimy, semi-abandoned building somewhere in the downtown east side, which has this great sort of, like, 70s underground New York Hellfire Club kind of vibe to it. It's like, you're doing this... you're hanging out with a rough trade and stuff like that. But it was also cold and dark and the ceilings were too low and you couldn't see a damn thing. And, there wasn't equipment.
It's no fun with BDSM if you can't see.
No, it's not.
Unless you're blinded.
Unless you're wearing a blindfold. So there was, and that eventually, that group that did the bar night eventually became the National Lesbian Association of Canada, and that's when the NLA was sort of disintegrating in the States, and it sort of split off, became, I believe, the NLAC, National Leather Association Canada.
National Leather Association.
Canada. And that turned into, it was called Vantasm.
Vantasm?
Yeah, which nobody could figure out how it could pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
People kept saying Vanta SM, which... yeah, and that eventually became the Other Side. And the Other Side organized what was called Purgatory, which was also in...
I remember that.
Yeah, that was in down in the industrial section, like Hastings and Commercial.
Okay.
A few blocks away from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I believe it had been a sweatshop of some description before that. You had to go up a couple of stories in an elevator. It's kind of a best of times, worst of times period. Because
in Vancouver, yes.
Yeah,
sweatshop made me think of slaves, though. So, I mean, that kind of ties in. So maybe that's...
Yeah, it's got that, like I said, there's that... industrial look people mm-hmm. like to have.
So you'd say that it has changed in Vancouver then a bit. How has it changed?
Now it's very vital. There's a lot going on. There's something going on for every taste. There's fetish nights. There's play parties. There's two different play parties depending on, which particular crowd you like to go to.
Mm-hmm.
People are doing stuff like community organizations, commercial ventures.
Libido Events just opened up a big play spot. Jennifer's totally making one of her major dreams come true with Libido Events, so check that out online as well. It's a big deal.
Yeah, and and there's also Bio, which is going to launch a separate non-commercial, non-profit organization. Mm-hmm. And,
lots of things happening.
Yeah, lots of things. There's munches, there's educational seminars, there's all kinds of stuff. I can honestly say that there's more going on.
Mm-hmm.
And more quality stuff going on in the last few years than there's been there was in a long time.
That's great.
Well, I know fetish wise, I've been to one of the Sin City events, and I think the first time I went as a schoolgirl, so I could giggle if I felt uncomfortable.
Classic.
And I know I make a really great schoolgirl too. Don't you think so, Julia?
Yes,
you spanked my bottom before.
Yes, I'll spank it again.
Oh, I think I might like that. But with that, I remember walking in there and watching a girl who was dressed up as schoolgirl smacking this guy who's about 300 pounds where he was leaning over and she was just flogging him. And I wasn't sure whether to laugh or not at the time, but it sounds definitely different than it was 10 years ago. So it's cool that people are able to have that
venue and outlets and public. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we haven't really even for the listeners defined kink or BDSM, mm-hmm. so maybe we could just backtrack a little bit and talk about that for a minute.
Okay. Well, some people say erotic is using a feather and making love, and other people say kinky is using a whole chicken.
I just got images of how you could use that chicken.
That's funny.
Well, the beak would hurt.
Where would the chicken be?
I could draw a diagram, but that wouldn't come true on radio.
No,
but you can paint us a picture with words. I want the penthouse letter
version.
We'll let the listeners
paint their own picture about the chicken. Okay, so the definition then of BDSM, because I was sort of saying that, you know, the bondage discipline, sadism, masochism, the technical meaning for the acronym. But what would you sort of describe BDSM as?
That's a real line in the sand question. Uh-huh. But sometimes I have to admit that in my research and my life, I fall back on I know it when I see it.
Okay.
But more helpfully, S&M uses its sex that involves role play. It involves using implements, using toys and tools, and I believe since human beings are a tool-using species, I think it's natural for us to use toys and tools and sex. It's also based on role play, which involves a variety of dominant and submissive roles, which can be master-slave, mistress-slave.
Right. So it's a top-bottom situation. It's a power thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then, just to make things confusing, some people practice SM play without any of that dominant submissive role play at all. And so you'll see somebody flogging somebody else, but the person being flogged will completely control everything, and there's no pretense of them being a slave or a prisoner or what have you.
Mm, okay.
So it's
Well, it sounds like it's sort of a gray area.
Mm-hmm. It's a gray area, but to me, what's important is that there's a sense of ritualism involved into mm-hmm. it, and there's a sense of going through the process. There's a narrative to the scene that between the person, people involved in SM play. There's roles, there's titles, there's costumes, there's objects that have great symbolic value.
Okay.
And that's part of the arousal that we seek. And it's, in a sense, about developing a way of developing a new identity, that you can sort of step outside yourself and become somebody else for a while.
Right.
And many people find that, separate from the sexual elements, the arousal is that they find it just a relief to be somebody else for a while, to be, you know, a slave or a child or an animal, an inanimate object even,
mm-hmm.
or to be the pseudo-aristocratic master or mistress that you'd like to be.
Sounds like some creative ideas that we can all take from that. So tonight's show is about the history, and I know that you are a historian. You've done your undergrad in history.
Yeah.
What made you decide to research the history of kink and BDSM?
Well, I think it was Toni Morrison who said that you should write the book you'd always want to read.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, I like history, I like S&M, and I like writing, so let's combine the three.
Okay.
The second point is that I've really noticed the state of the art in the history of SM studies is really, really poor, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of mythology and outright BS that gets thrown around.
Right.
There's people who will invoke this image of noble slave training houses that go back to ancient Rome and things like that, and you know they'll claim that they're part of an unbroken lineage of master and slave that goes back thousands of years and things like that. And as far as I can tell, those belong in the same category as like satanic ritual abuse cults and things like that. They really just don't exist, even though many people would like them to.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that there really isn't a more solidly researched and documented history to replace that, or at least not that I've found so far.
Mm-hmm.
And so this sort of mythology steps in to fill the gap, and which is, to my mind, really a shame, because to my mind, there's a really fascinating history that just hasn't been told anywhere yet.
Mm-hmm. Right, good. Well,
as far as I can tell, there's never been a comprehensive history of SM. There's been like books on fashion and fetishism and the growth of you know, say, gay culture and things like that, but mm-hmm. there's, to my knowledge, never been a comprehensive SM history book.
Right.
I hope to be the first.
Awesome. Cool. I'm very excited about your excitement and the fact that you're filling a gap in the, you know, the world out there of books and of research. So, good for you.
Thank you.
Oh, that's good. So I guess I kind of want to get into you and Caroline had a nice long conversation earlier this week and had a pre-interview about the whole history thing and went on for quite some time. So you were going to be very succinct tonight and get into that now. So.
Yeah, like I just wanted to touch base about that cult that we were talking about at the very beginning when I asked at the very about the cult of Dionysus.
Dionysus.
Am I pronouncing that incorrectly?
Yeah. That's the starting point that I use when I do presentations and lectures every once in a while. And the starting point I do in this is what was called the Villa of the Mysteries, to be nice and evocative about it. And this was a house, a nobleman's house, that was preserved in Pompeii in Rome in, I believe, 71 BC. And this was under the volcanic eruption that buried everything.
Okay.
And this was a fairly large room with a mural going all around the walls, life-size. And it shows sort of a sequential story of a young woman going through a kind of ritual process that...
Give me the Pentos Letters version.
Okay.
Sex it up.
All right. Well, she's naked in most of it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Does she have nice breasts? I'm sorry, I have to ask these questions. I want to see it.
She has nice breasts. She's very... She's a strikingly attractive young woman.
Nice.
She's in most of the depictions in the mural, she's naked or nude. There's lots of weird symbology, but when it gets really interesting is about three quarters of the way through the mural, and we see a different woman wearing boots and with black wings sprouting from her shoulders, wielding apparently a cane or a rod of some kind.
Nice.
And she is beating the winged woman is beating the initiate, the woman who's going through the initiation, who is crouched down on her knees in the next section of the mural.
Can you see her face in it? Does she look like she's in ecstasy or is she in pain?
Well, ecstasy is a hard thing to say. Like, you know, the face...
That's true. People have screwed up funny faces.
Oh, yeah.
They don't have Pentos porno faces when they're having sex.
Yeah. So, and in the next panel...
How do you know, Ken?
So she's
know. I know what I look like in the mirror. It's scary. I don't want to look. It's why I shut my eyes.
Yeah. And in the next panel, section of the panel, the woman initiated is dancing ecstatically. She's got like purple scarves swirling around her. She's got little, I believe she has little castanets above her, and that she's dancing ecstatically after being flogged. Now, there's a lot of different interpretations about this. Nobody is really sure what this means, really positively.
What does it mean to you?
What does it mean to me? What it means is that there was SM-like behavior that was being used in initiation rituals. And you can find this in other kinds of initiation rituals. You can find...
Such as?
Flogging. You can find things like gender inversion. You had one of the things that happened in the cult of Dionysus. Gender inversion.
Gender inversion. What would that be?
That would be like women ruling men, women dominating men, or dressing, or one sex dressing as another. And
I think I might like to try that.
Cross-dressing.
Yeah,
or at least dominating.
This is what these cults were all about, is that they were about, in many ways, about, you know, stepping out of your everyday life and being part of this radically different world where all these different rules applied, and you could be, some middle-aged housewife could be this goddess-like figure that figuratively kills the god Dionysus and rips him to shreds, and then he's reborn again later.
Nice.
And so that's my usual starting point on talking about this. But I also have to emphasize that this was part of religion. This is a religious practice.
Yes.
And it's not...
BDSM is a religious practice?
I would say it's not primary.
Can you explain what you mean by this religious practice, this religious aspect?
Well, I'm saying, you see, like, I'm trying to define where SM begins and SM's end. Because, like, you can look at all cultures all over the world, and they do SM-like practices as part of their religious practices. In Native America, you have okipa, which involves hanging suspended by hooks embedded in the flesh. In India, you've got taipusam, which involves, weights and fruits being, again, hooked into the flesh. And In medieval Christianity, you had flagellation, but all of these things were the part of religion. They were part of religious practice. They weren't a recreational thing. They weren't part of recreation, something people had to do. SM is something you don't have to do, but these rituals are things you have to do, or otherwise you're not part of your society.
Hey,
this is what you have to do to become an adult or a man.
Is it
kind of
like yoga, where you have to sit in the awful meditation pose for forever so then you can see enlightenment later on?
In a very mild sense, yeah. Right. It's a very,
my feet always fall asleep.
It's a very common practice, is that of sensory overload or sensory deprivation in order to get you out of yourself.
It's true.
And, you know, develop a different, you know, experience yourself differently, have a different identity. And yoga is, again, yoga is a part of that. Runner's high is a part of that.
Yeah.
People, you know, do it all over the way. And it's just, SM is just one particular way of doing that. And
what I was going to ask, because you'd mentioned in terms of in that mural that she was wearing boots and she had a cane.
Yeah.
What other types of devices did you find? You saw that. You saw the cane. You saw the boots. I'm curious to see if they had stilettos on them or not. They probably didn't back in the day.
High heels weren't invented until sometime later.
Okay.
They were, according to one theory, they were invented after the stirrup to keep boots from slipping out of stirrups.
Ah, okay.
And they were, intriguing enough, they were initially a male article of clothing.
Yeah,
and
nice.
As
were wigs and, you know.
That's true. The powdered face with arsenic.
Yeah, actually, it's really, if you look into history, most distinctively female attire actually started out being worn by men, and they are gradually abandoned over time, and they sort of shifted over to being worn by women.
Do you think it had to do with cross-dressing or anything like that eventually, or?
In a sense, yes, in the sense that there's this long history of female fashion borrowing bits of male fashion in a stylized or simplified or diminished sense. Like one book argues that the corset, which most people see as a quintessentially feminine garment, actually developed out of male body armor in the Middle Ages.
Really?
And that male armor created the sense of male clothing that looked armored, and then at a certain point, I believe in the 16th century, men and women were at least from the waist up dressed almost identically with similar silhouettes. And then that sort of diminished over time, that the stays or otherwise that men and women both wore, that gradually evolved towards the corset, which became, by the 19th century, was like pretty much universally worn by women of all social standings.
Which even present day, I mean, guys love women in corsets, which is interesting. And I'm just curious in terms of that, about the fact that I know when wearing them sometimes it's really hard to breathe in, and it's kind of that whole feeling of being tied up. Does that tie in any way, shape, or form in terms of the BDSM factor?
That's
the bondage.
It's definitely, there's a linkage there, because you've got it changes your sense of yourself. It changes how you your body feels to yourself, and that's, you know, in a sense that it makes you feel, it requires a more upright posture. So it can make you feel, many women who wear corsets, actually, they don't feel oppressed by it today. They don't feel oppressed by it. They don't feel strangulated, but they feel stronger. They feel tighter. They feel, you know, more erect almost. And there's...
That makes me think of penis, is that word.
Well, yeah, if you want to get really Freudian about it, you could say that it's really it's all about, you know, making the female body hard and
more like a man.
Almost, yeah. That's one theory that's behind it.
Interesting.
Yeah, and in some way, I would say it's actually a refutation of motherhood. It's like a refutation of saying, is that look how not pregnant I am. One theory is that Victorian corsets were actually a rejection of the fetish of the motherhood ideal of the Victorians.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
I don't know why. It made me think of the Passion of Christ, actually, because I guess because it's all erect and the arms out to the side. So it makes me think of Christ being nailed to the cross, which is really warped and twisted, but I guess that gets us back to the whole religion factor in terms of that. Because you'd mentioned that the other day when we met up, that... in terms of in our conversation about BDSM and just the details, and why do you think that this movie has to do with BDSM in terms of
the Passion of Christ? You were saying that,
Passion of Christ is a very odd movie from my perspective, because like I was watching this and thinking this is a homoerotic snuff film.
Sorry, I haven't seen it, so that's why I'm laughing.
Oh, God. You really should.
I'm laughing because it's very well put, actually. It's a Homer Rodgers novel.
It's like, you know, somebody went, you ever see the Ten Commandments? Somebody once said that is the only orgy you will. Ten Commandments. That is the only orgy you will ever see in a G-rated movie. Well, Passion of the Christ is the only snuff film you will ever see that got was like number three at the box office.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's, you know, and I am positive that somebody when they were making this movie, somebody stopped and looked at this and said, "We need more blood." The whole process of the Passion of the Christ, and it's focused entirely on the Passion, nothing about the teachings, nothing about that. It's all about the flogging, the scourging, the crown of thorns, the sponge soaked in vinegar, the spear in his side. There's even stuff that's not even in Scripture.
Stuff about the prostitute, too, right?
Yeah, Mary Magdalene. Yeah, and she's, you know, she's there. There's all these other roles that have to be played. She's sort of an observer to the scene going on below. They were kind of like, you know, touchy about that because the idea that of Mary Magdalene being a prostitute and being that Christ and her were lovers is a very touchy area for many people. But the incredible emphasis on this, and this is you know, minute after minute after minute of this beating, and it's preceded by the fact that we're invited to look at Jim Cavaziel, who played Christ. We're invited to look at this man and see how beautiful he is, and then we're turned around and we're seeing this beautiful body being ruined right in front of our eyes. We're seeing the metal tipped scourges literally digging into his skin, and you can hear it. You can hear the sound of it being pulled out of his flesh. And whoever did the sound design on this movie must have put in a lot of work. Okay, what does metal being embedded and pulled out of human flesh sound like?
So there's BDSM involved. It sounds like it's blood play. It's pretty extreme BDSM going on.
But you see, this is the problem, is that the people who made this movie...
are Christians, aren't they?
Yes, they're Christians. They would not consider this S&M. This is the Passion. This is showing how Christ suffered for us. This is showing... And yet, you know, there's an incredible emphasis on this. And, like, if you look at the Scriptures themselves, it's actually not described in any great detail.
Mm-hmm.
So this blood and guts version of Christianity is a very recurring theme that keeps popping up every so often. There is there's a period in time where, you know, when depictions of Christ were mostly of him as a teacher and these very benevolent, peaceful mm-hmm. depictions. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point in Western civilization, you got all this imagery of Christ beaten and bloodied and ruined, his, you know, flesh rotting mm-hmm. on his bones and strung up like that, and everyone around him weeping. And it's like, the idea was that this is part of empathy. This is the idea is that a Christian would mm-hmm. look at this image of this man beaten and bloodied and, you know, pierced on the verge of death,
mm-hmm.
painful, excruciating, drawn out death. And you were supposed to meditate on this. You were supposed to look at this and just feel this in yourself.
Interesting.
Do you think online, I'm just curious in terms of chat rooms, in terms of that, do you think anybody who's really into blood play might have found this really highly erotic? And have you seen any of that online?
Not personally. I don't spend a lot of time in chat rooms. I'm much more interested in what people do in person rather than what they do online.
Or anybody that you met in person that you discussed the movie with in the community that might have been really into?
People have agreed with me that there is a kind of sadomasochistic emphasis to this film that it is. But this is like, it's strange that we're seeing this long part of this like resurgence in the idea of, you know, Christ suffered for us. Christ, and this is part of, mm-hmm. you know, a very conservative agenda that being run by people who would have no patience whatsoever with
the whole BDSM.
With BDSM or the whole alternative sex culture.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I believe that many people would agree with me that this is informed by the idea of sadomasochism, or it draws from the same source of the idea of sadomasochism.
Hmm.
Like, you know, like if you've ever seen Mel Gibson's movies, who directed this,
mm-hmm.
his characters are very often tortured.
He's a Christian man, if I remember correctly.
He's quite blatant about that. I wanted to say blatant. I want to say quite forthright about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this, I think, is that it sort of draws on the same thing, that the image of a human body in agony or in ecstasy, but at the physical extremes is a way of getting out of yourself. And by empathizing with that, you can get out of yourself and free yourself to be, to think in a different way, to experience yourself in a different way.
To change.
And there's a potential for change there.
Nice.
Well, I think we'll just take
a short break.
Yeah. Keep that dialogue to hear more with Peter Tupper and the history of BDSM. We do welcome your calls during this time, especially. So call in at 604-822-2487. That's UBC-CITR. You are in Juice Box, featured on Vancouver's 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Oh, sorry. CITR. Yes. How many times can we say it?
CITR.
And we're going to play a little Ghost in Stormy Nights tonight.
And
from
if you've
Tokyo.
Had any erotic fantasies about ghosts or BDSM or any experiences, we want you to call in or send us your sexy penthouse letters. Send them to us.
And we'll be right back.
The NCRC National Campus and Community Radio Conference and CITR present the NCRC Awards Night, June 15th, 9 p.m. at the Ukrainian Hall with the Evaporators. The choir practice. And Chris Arifik, come and celebrate with us Friday, June 15th, 9 p.m., $8 at the Ukrainian Hall, 805 East Bender, 19 and over only. Tickets available at Zulu, Scratch, High Life, and Red Cat Records.
Sexuality education geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back. Julia's engineering again, once again, is not so good. All right, so welcome back to Juicebox Radio. We are going to do Juice Berries first before we get back to our interview on the history of BDSM with Peter Tepper. First and foremost, I want to announce the Petals movie that's coming up this Saturday at the Roundhouse. Tickets you can be bought for quite cheap at the Art of Loving and Little Sisters, but you can also come to the door. Roundhouse Community Center shows are at 7 and 9 on Saturday.
And I believe our special Julia Saunders is going to be guest
announcing.
There.
I'll be announcing the movies, and then we'll be doing a Q&A and other things after. And it's quite an amazing film. I think if you want to check out a little bit more about it, you can check out PetalsTheJourney.com.
As well, on June 21st, there's awards and fashion gala from Babs, Real Sizes for Real Women. Where? At the Listel Hotel. And what? It's that model contest of women of all sizes. So whether you're 300 pounds or whether you're two. Well, maybe not if you're two.
Oh, yeah, 100 pounds. Under 100 pounds or over 300. The point is that Babs, I think we've been talking about this for the last
few weeks
about the model contest. Well, she's had 90 models go in, and they're doing the awards and the fashion gala. So I think it'll be quite a fabulous night. I recommend that you go and check it out. Tickets are available at babs.ca, I think, or babs.com. I cut off the bottom of it. Great, Julia.
No, it's good. As well, if you're interested in experiencing a little bit of fetish, a little bit of kink yourself, and you live in Vancouver, why don't you check out Sin City every second Saturday of the month at 23 West Cordova. Just check it out online. Check it.
It is babs.ca, B-A-B-S.ca. And what else? We have the Anza Club tomorrow night. At the Anza Club, there is a World Beat Night, and Julia will be bartending. So come and check it out. I mean, the music's going to be fabulous. Pendo Moja, Santa Lucia, and others. Doors are at 8 at the Anza Club. Very inexpensive. Part of the conference that's going on this week for the National Community and Campus Radio Conference that is happening all week downtown and partially here as well at CITR, being hosted by CITR in Vancouver. So, and I'll be at workshops. There's fabulous workshops happening. Go and check it out. It started yesterday, and it goes until Saturday. So yeah, I think you've probably been listening to that a lot, though, if you've been listening to CITR lately. And also the rclub.ca, the old rendezvous club. Caroline and I are going to be at the next 30 to 40 year old speed dating event on July 12th. That's a Thursday night, so we won't have to like race back here all peppered up with our breaking the tops of the roses off on our way.
It's very highly entertaining.
We'll be reviewing it soon, and our little juice box boy Charles is guesting us there for that night on the 12th. So do come and date Caroline and I for 5 minutes each.
And you get the blonde and the brunette.
Yeah, it'll be fun. So what other, we have the last
We've
juice
also
berry?
Got last but not least, and leading back to our guest, you can actually see Peter Tepper in person at the Art of Loving. That's June the 26th, and he is bringing his hands out, if you can see him, and his chest is extended right now. It's quite lovely, actually, from 7:30 to 9:30. So what are you going to be talking about at Art of Loving?
I'm going to be doing my full presentation. I always alter it just a little each time and try to, you know, based on my new research and some images that go back, some of them go back hundreds or thousands of years that show you about the evolution of SM in our society. And so it turns up in all kinds of interesting places. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. I want to know, because I know we unfortunately can't show on air, which kind of sucks, because it'd be kind of nice to be able to do that, but we can paint it with words. Yeah. And with painting with words, can you tell me about any documented cases? What are the earliest ones with BDSM?
Okay. The in my opinion, the earliest documented SM relationship was between a man named Arthur Munby and a woman named Hannah Colwick. And he was a gentleman, a Victorian gentleman, and she was a maid of all work. And they met in 1854, and they had a master-slave relationship, a consensual master-slave relationship, which lasted for, a good 20 years.
So they had a nice serial monogamy relationship as well. I like
it. Munby was an interesting case because...
Okay. I'm like, what does serial monogamy mean? Okay, yes, right? Master-slave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You see, Munby was obsessed with working-class women. His favorite thing to do was go out into the streets of London or Manchester and places like that and walk up to charwomen, maids of all work, milkmaids, orange sellers, the women who did the hardest, dirtiest, grubbiest work he could find, and ask them about their lives. And he'd take notes about them, and he'd collect pictures of them. He collected something like 600 or 700 pictures of working women from London at that time. And
he liked to fuck them when they were dirty, too, didn't he?
Okay.
I heard something about that. He liked to get his woman.
He loved to get her
dirty women. He was fascinated by dirty women. He was, you know, smeared with mud, with lead. And this is before when, you know, keeping a house clean was very dirty stuff. This is, you know, there were no vacuum cleaners. You know, soap was like brand new. And now it's important to realize he didn't fuck them. I don't think, there's no evidence he ever did. Like, he was one of these very odd sort of Victorian, Edwardian men who had...
Maybe he was gay.
Well, you know, he seemed to have very...
So it was a possibility.
I think Munby is in his own category. He is his own entity, all unto himself.
Okay.
And Hannah Colwick met his type perfectly. She was huge by Victorian standards. She was 5'7", and you know, that was well
back
above average size for a woman. She was incredibly strong. She could lift up a fully grown man and carry him around a kitchen table.
Fabulous.
She had something like, 17-inch biceps, something like
wow.
that. He loved, you know,
wow.
he would measure. And she would do work like you wouldn't believe. She would do the hardest, dirtiest, grubbiest work she could. She would clean boots by licking them. She once told Munby that she could tell where he had been by how his boots tasted.
Oh, God.
Do you have any, because you're mentioning that their journals actually survive to this day. Is there anything that is there that is kind of kinky, that's kind of sexy?
This isn't kinky already?
Well,
yeah, I was
going to
say the boots are, that's pretty
it's
kinky.
It's not my version of kinky. It's different, but it's neat. I'd be curious to hear
this is.
I've never licked anybody's boots.
Okay, so this Pygmalion complex. Yes. Let's talk Pygmalion. About that for a minute.
Yeah.
We've got 15 minutes here, guys.
Yeah. She would wear, she wore a locked chain collar around her neck, and she would also wear a leather strap around her wrist. And those were both sort of visible signs of the work that she did for him.
But at the same time, didn't he take her off to court and stuff like that, where he'd pass her off as a lady?
They were secretly married in 1873, after knowing each other for 19 years. And the funny thing is that the marriage was a secret. As far as the world knew, he was just living with his maid of all work. But when they traveled in Europe, that's when she would dress up as a lady and be his lady wife traveling in Europe. And then they go back to England and she was his maid again.
Would anybody notice because of her accent or anything that she was different?
Not in Europe, because they wouldn't be able to tell an upper-class English accent from a lower-class English accent. Although she did have to wear gloves to cover up her hands.
The Scarlett O'Hara hand.
Yeah. There's a great image of... he kept this image, this little keepsake image of her that was sort of two pictures face to face. One of them was her as dressed up as a lady, and the other of her was naked, almost naked, crouching at his feet, wearing the collar and her wrist strap visible, looking up at him beseechingly. And
it's like the lady and the whore. Which is every man's dream.
Yeah. But it's the lady and
poor
the
Madonna,
drudge.
Madonna, you mean?
It's the lady and the drudge.
Okay.
It's the lady and the drudge is what he's looking for, almost.
Right.
Is that he had this dream that was fascinating to him, was the idea that a woman could do all this brutal, hard work and yet still be nice and gentle and loving. And this was Munby was raised by... We know a lot about these two people because they both wrote detailed journals and they were left to posterity. They came out of archive in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
that he was raised by a nanny named, who was also named Hannah. And
I think that's funny.
Yeah. Like the theory goes is that many Victorian men and women were actually raised by their nurses and nannies and not by their mothers. Their mother was this distant figure who was aspiring to upper class standards of womanhood, and the children were actually raised by their nurses, their governesses, who were often...
You're mentioning even the grocer, would have somebody working for him.
Yeah, the defining
well.
Characteristic of being middle class in Victorian England was having servants, even if it was just a maid of all work. And even like grocers and butchers would have them. And, mm-hmm. and being without help was a dire sign of being in trouble. And so...
You were mentioning the other day that men of that class, a lot of times their first sexual experience would be with a servant. Because that was the... And you were suggesting perhaps that was because that was the women that they knew how to relate to.
Yeah, this is the women who they grew up with, the women who introduced them to the world.
Would that be like sexual abuse then? Like...
That's a
by today's standards?
It's a very, very tricky element here. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes, like, I mean, I don't want to excuse it by saying that there probably was a lot of exploitation going on mm-hmm. that, you know, that servants could be easily be, a child could easily accuse a servant of being a thief or mm-hmm. something like that and have her sacked. So there was a very, it's a very touchy power dynamic between the two. On the other hand, on the one hand, the
little kids growing up, knowing that that's my slave from the time you're a kid, and even though they punish you a little bit and stuff, like, oh, you didn't pick up your clothes, you know, I'm going to give you a smack on your bottom now, but like in a couple of years, when they're 10, they're ordering this person around.
Especially since some of the servants were very young. There were girls working as servants as young as 8. Hannah Colwick started working as a servant at age 8. And, but there was, on the same time, it could work both ways. And there was a certain ambiguous power dynamic going on between the two is that.
How long ago was that? That was about the 1870s-ish?
Well, Munby and Colwick met in 1854. So mm-hmm. this was a dynamic that had been going on for several generations of it's at a certain point in English history, something like 1 in 5 women over the age of 10 was working as a domestic servant.
Wow.
So a lot of men grew up with believing that sort of their first sexual object, their first sexual experiences was with domestic servants.
It's better that than with their mother. That would be disturbing.
But also this is what often with the women who had been their mother figure who had done the hard work of actually raising them.
How do you think that affects men today?
Well, domestic service is kind of an outside, not many people have it anymore. So I think a relative minority of people, mm-hmm. like lots of people have babysitters and things like that, but they're not in that same sort of hot house environment.
That's true. Although people do have fantasies about their babysitter as well. I think the whole Lolita thing.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do is that they have crushes on sort of the first woman, maybe even like the sense of that here's a woman who's in the house with you, but she's not part of your family. So, all of your sexual curiosity comes out directed at this person.
That's
and I think
true.
This comes, and mm-hmm. you can see this surviving today in fantasies of, like you brought
the
up,
babysitter.
Like the babysitter mm-hmm. fantasy, but also you mentioned, you mentioned like the French maids who, services
totally.
Who come and yeah.
Yeah, where you walk around and it's like, hello, I'm like naked and I'm going to clean your place now. Yeah. I can't do a very good French accent as you guys can all hear as Julia's just shuddering. I can't believe you did that.
That's actually why the French maid outfit was invented.
So I didn't have to pretend I have an accent. Well, I can just role play in my little sexy little black thing with my little lace.
Why was it invented?
It was invented sort of as a way of policing the boundaries between wife and maid is keeping so that the maid wouldn't be in danger of dressing better than the woman she worked for.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So the classic black and white uniform was an afternoon maid's dress, and that gradually became simplified and sexualized.
Right.
So in a very peculiar sense, what was precisely supposed to make them look unattractive
made them hot.
Became,
but it's the same as present day men in uniforms. I mean, I have a thing for firemen. I'll totally admit it. It's really sexy because it is.
Uniforms are very hot. Yeah. What's this Pygmalion? Somebody speak to that first.
Oh, we did already. Oh.
There was a Pygmalion element.
I missed it.
About
basically
how he dress her up like a lady and try and pass her off.
It was sort of a half-hearted thing because she really didn't want to be.
And also the slave.
She didn't want to be a lady because she'd figured, because like she, you know, even though she called herself a drudge and a slave, even though she did all this backbreaking work.
She liked it.
She liked it. And furthermore, she, you know, she always made a point of having a year's worth of savings to fall back on.
So she could always leave if she
wanted to. Yeah, she was reluctant to marry him. She was a very tough woman.
She was like a feminist in her own time.
And a very, well, I mean, like, if as much as a feminist.
Can be a slave and can be a domestic servant as a feminist.
I think there's something kind of powerful about being a servant sometimes.
I mean, she understood that this was the terms of her relationship. Mm-hmm. And if she felt those terms were being violated, she would leave him. And she did. She left him in 1877. And they kept seeing each other later on in life. But there was a definite sense that she felt that if the terms of their relationship were being broken, she would stand up for herself. And I think you see that in a lot of women who define themselves as submissive today, is that they love to be that position of being controlled, of being owned, of being of doing this, you know, work that and gaining value for that. But at the same time, they... You know,
some of them are really powerful women in real life where they like to basically it's like it's kind of nice, you know, have that caveman quality like you bend over, lean over, let me fuck you.
Yeah. And but the trick is that they can always like shut it off when they feel like it.
Like, do you like that, Julia?
Like
me to bend you over?
Okay, guys.
I'm going to go on with this. In terms of the stuff you've seen in terms of history, how has that affected in a sexual way your take on the kink scene now? Like, have you taken anything, like, say, that going back right at the very beginning of this conversation with the boots and the cane and actually kind of seen people reenact any of that stuff? Or?
I see it as, when I look at the kink scene today, I love seeing the diversity, and I love seeing that people are pursuing what has meaning to them.
Such as?
That of finding spirituality in doing physical ordeal rituals like the okipa with the hooks embedded in their flesh, or that they can find a relationship that makes sense to them and makes them feel loved and belonging, whether it's, you know, being an age play relationship or a master-slave or mistress-slave relationship. I think it's great that there's so much diversity of it and so much... And I'd see that this is kind of an ongoing part of people being able to define themselves and create a life that makes meaning for them instead of, like, accepting the roles that are assigned to them by their place of birth, by their social class.
It's not just the elite. In other words, it's kind of embraced by middle class right all the way through.
I'd say that I'd go so far as to argue that SM is really a middle class parody of aristocratic manners.
Okay.
Because
it's all the decadence and the...
Yeah, it's middle-class excess. People acting the way they think aristocratic people act.
Okay. So not like Britney Spears? I'm just teasing. What's the kinkiest thing you've seen you've been involved with?
Kinkiest thing I've ever been involved in? One woman I know, she... did this thing where, first I had a rope harness put on myself, a Japanese-style torso rope harness. Then I was mummified in saran wrap.
I've been all mummified in saran wrap before.
Yeah. But it's a layers thing.
Have you?
It's a layers thing. Then when I was standing in that, I'm not sure I was able to stand in this, but I was standing. We went over to the bondage rack, and she made a web out of packing tape. So I was like this fly suspended up in this
web of packing tape. Wow.
Yeah, and she was like, she had even dressed in her Spider Woman outfit for this. And so I appreciate costumes. I mean, it adds a little certain something.
Really cool.
Yeah, and that was one of my favorite scenes I've ever.
Where
made.
What were
that?
You wearing?
I was wearing very little.
Because I'm just wondering, doesn't that like the packing tape?
Because first the rope harness, then the saran wrap, and then the packing tape.
Okay, so all in one.
Yeah.
So I had this vision of it ripping skin off when it was pulling the packing tape off.
Oh yeah, no. Where was this done?
That was at Studio Q. That was when was that? Something like 2000, 2001. And if she's listening, I still have fond memories of her.
So spider, maybe she'll call you. Spider top woman. Okay.
Yeah.
I love it.
Cool. What about, like, I don't know, my experience with BDSM, I've had some, where I was always the mistress that was doing things to other people.
I can just imagine that, Julia.
It's fun, actually. I really enjoyed torturing people a little bit for some reason and pulling on their genitals and tying things to their genitals. And they loved it, so I was having a good time. I flogged people a lot as well. I really enjoyed that. Made quite a scene for myself at this party. That happened at least 3 or 4 times in my swinger days with the old Don, the Don days.
I shudder again. But, I shudder thrice.
But I found BDSM people to be very, very intense and kind of dark. And since those days, I've kind of come to see that there's some demons that are being worked out in the old BDSM situation, I think. So I'm wondering if you could just speak to that in the last few minutes of the show. What you think about people that really like to get tied up, dominated, beaten, whatever is going on with their thing. Do you think there's any kind of connection to them and perhaps how they were treated when they were little children? Or what happened to them and were they abused? Or
I don't think...
What demons they might have to work out?
Abuse is a tricky thing. That's a scary word. I think that very often it is people who are doing working out stuff that they had with their parents or stuff like you. I think a lot of guys, guys who are into dominant women, want to have that kind of intense female attention that maybe they didn't get from their moms. I think a lot of sub women want to deal with. Have issues with their father. But I also want to emphasize that that doesn't necessarily mean that they're damaged. I don't think that nobody had perfect parents. Nobody had, there's always a little part of us that wishes that maybe we had things worked a little differently or we did something like that. So I can look in my own life and I can say that there are issues in my upbringing that inform my kink life today, which is as a straight male sub. But at the same time, I don't think that means that this is a symptom of a sickness. It's not. There's so many other things, to say that would be reductionist. There's so many other things people do. There's so many other ways people experience it that there's the opportunity to be somebody different. There's the opportunity to...
For sure.
Relive your life and maybe sort of restage your life in the way it should have been or could have been or be the person you would have liked to have been in somehow, but you aren't.
Is this the kind of stuff you write on your blog sometimes?
Yeah.
For your Beauty of Darkness?
Yeah, that's beautyindarkness.blog.ca, and that's where I do regular, but fairly often talks about my research as I'm going and comments on the things, that just strike my fancy. Like I was listening to reading some other blogs, like some female dominance blogs, talking about say Jack Bauer on 24 as a masochist, and I was thinking, no, the man's a sadist, pure and simple, and I'm just saying, and that sort of helps me refine my thinking about what is sadism, what is masochism, what is stoicism, psychology, the whys and hows, what are we doing, what is when a person is being flogged, what are they really doing?
Right. So that's all the time we have tonight.
Thank you so much for coming out to see us.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate this.
I love talking about this with just about anybody.
Yeah, and so keep us up to date on your book process and the history of BDSM, and thank you for producing hopefully something that will open the doors for people to sort of look into the past and connect ourselves to the present day.
And we hope you're...
I think it's really cool that you're writing that book, so...
It's very cool, and we hope on the 26th that at your workshop at the Art of Loving, your talk is going to go, I'm sure it's going to go awesome. So.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you.
Thanks
You're
for being
welcome.
On the show. Wow. So we hope you tonight enjoyed tonight's show. Caroline and I are going to be back next week with another fresh and lively Juice Box. But in the meantime, email us at juiceboxradio.com. Stay tuned for Hans Claus's Misery Hour with Marion coming up next on CITR. He is a very sexy man to be miserable with.
You should let him guide you into the wee hours with his ambient collection of music he's laughing as we talk about his super hot voice.
Yes, yes. I listen to him all the way home, and then as I fall asleep before I touch myself.
Would you three like to be alone?
I touch myself.
London brunette syndrome all the time.
Thanks for listening to Juice Box Radio. We will be back next week
at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock.
You just experienced Juice Box Radio, a show dedicated to developing your relational and individual sexual health, expressing diversity, celebrating queerness, and encouraging pleasure at all stages. Be sure to tune into Juice Box every Wednesday night at 10. In the meantime, you can check out juiceboxradio.com. Thanks for listening. You're gonna have to give it to me.